Hi, this is Eric. Before we start, some listeners have asked me to give you a status of the 4Z1UG QTH and family during the war in Israel against Hamas. Because the QSO Today interviews should be timeless oral histories, I'm writing a blog on the QSO Today website. As long as you see me posting new episodes of QSO Today every week, then you know that I and my family are still here. Being in a war zone, an hour from the front, is complex. Still, those of us not on the front have to hold up the home front until life returns to normal, so we try to act as normal as possible. I appreciate so much your messages of support during this difficult time. Thank you. QSO Today, Episode 484, Richard Gutknecht, NZ2I. This episode of QSO Today is listener-sponsored. Only you can keep the QSO Today podcast coming to you every weekend since 2014. Please become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor banner on the show notes page or at the top of the QSOtoday.com webpage. Mike McRoberts, KD6FTR, is a new listener sponsor this week, and Ron Wilcox, KF7ZN, made a contribution of $15. There were additional but anonymous generous donations, and they are greatly appreciated. Welcome to the QSO Today podcast. I'm Eric Guth, amateur call sign 4Z1UG, where I demonstrate the diversity and relevance of the amateur radio hobby and its impact on society by interviewing ham radio operators, many of whom played vital roles in shaping our technology through the amateur radio hobby. And while many people might say, "Ham radio, do people still do that?" this podcast demonstrates through in-depth interviews just how amazing, diverse, and dynamic the amateur radio hobby continues to be. Richard Gutknecht, NZ2I, is a second-generation amateur radio operator, catching the bug at an early age and getting the novice license at age 15. Answering his country's call to duty, Rick joined the Air Force and became an active ham while stationed in Germany. Now retired, Rick enjoys getting on the air, volunteering for his amateur radio club, and now producing and co-hosting a podcast on current events and American history. NZ2I is my QSO today. NZ2I, this is Eric, 4Z1UG. Are you there, Rick?
4Z1UG, this is NZ2I. Shalom, Eric.
Shalom, Rick. Thanks for joining me on the QSO Today podcast. Can we start at the beginning of your ham radio story? When and how did it start for you?
Well, my ham radio career basically started at birth. My father was an amateur radio operator, and I remember amateur radio as early as I can remember. I grew up in southwestern New York in a little town called Celeron, just outside of Jamestown. And that's where I lived most of my growing up life. My father was quite an avid ham. He was a great electronics technician, although that wasn't his career. He actually worked in a factory that made automatic voting machines.
What was your father's name and call sign?
Robert Gutknecht, WB2EWU. May his memory be blessed.
Amen. And he was a licensed ham, like, from World War II?
Oh, my. I don't know exactly when he became licensed. That's something that I never even sat down and thought about talking to him about. But, you know, like I said, ever since I can remember, he was licensed. And he was active in Navy MARS, which also helped him in one of his passions. He was the first amateur radio in Chautauqua County, New York, to be on RTTY. He had an old Model 15 teletype. And, I mean, this was a good, it had the tape reader, the whole gig. He built an ST6 from scratch to interface with it.
And what is an ST6?
That's the interface between the radio and the teletype.
So that's the baud interface.
Right, that translates the baud into the mechanical signals the teletype used. He had that thing running, and that thing, when it was running, it would shake the whole house. It was great. I loved it. And you could, you know, the smell of the oil and everything from it and everything.
Because there's a motor that runs all the time in the Model 15.
Right.
And you could smell the oil kind of heating up and vaporizing.
And this is something that maybe a lot of hams don't know, and I don't even know how legal this was. But as a young preteen, teenager, this was intriguing to me because my dad would tune into some of these signals in RTTY, and there were some people that were great artists.
With characters.
Just the characters you can do on the teletype. And they actually did images out of the centerfold of Playboy, transmitted those over the air, and my dad would have some of those pinned up on the walls and stuff in his shack, which was an interesting thing that most people would not think about something like that going on amateur radio.
But it was clever. I think that there are probably some apps now on the internet where you could actually take a photo and have it turned into a Bado image. I'll have to look and see whether that's the case, but I remember those as well, and the people were quite good.
Yes. I mean, the artwork with these things was tremendous.
I remember a Mount Rushmore on RTTY.
Yeah.
I never ran RTTY, but I knew people that did it, and I saw the stuff that they were generating.
Yeah, it was interesting.
So he operated RTTY. Did he do contests and stuff, and did you participate with him?
He wasn't a big contester. He was more of a rag chewer. He did other modes as well. He did, you know, voice and CW. My brother, he now holds my dad's call sign in his memory, Jay. He was a CW nut. I know that he was certified up to, I think it was 35 words a minute by ARRL through their, you know, their certification program that they do on the air. And he could probably do faster than that when he was younger. I don't know about now, but he was really a whiz at it. And that was kind of made me envious because code was my nemesis in amateur radio. In fact, I still struggle with code, you know.
You actually write a little bit about that on your QRZ page, about some of the struggles that you had with code. When did you get your first license?
I got my first license. I was about 15, 16, right in that time frame. I don't know the exact year. I've looked it up in call books and got it as close as I could. And that's on my QRZ page there. And that was, at that time, that was a novice that, you know, expired. In fact, my dad actually was able to give me that first exam.
The first novice exam.
Yeah, the first novice exam. We had a little hunting camp out in Pennsylvania, and we sat down one day and, you know, did the test, and I was able to pass that. And at that time, there was no restriction against parents giving their children the test. Of course, that changed during that period that I held that license. The unfortunate thing is my first contact on CW, and my dad was even there backing me up, you know, to help copy. But unfortunately, the guy I was talking to, his CW was so bad that even my dad couldn't copy it. And that just was discouraging to me, you know, my first contact, and, you know, and it just didn't pan out, and it kind of, you know, soured me a bit, and I didn't do much operating with the first license. But then as the year, I think it was a year, went by and my license expired, I'm like, oh no, I got to do something about this. So fortunately, there was another ham in the, I guess it was in the local club that my dad knew, Jack Nord, AC2D. He gave me the exam. Of course, I was able to renew my license. And then the FCC made the greatest mistake they ever could have made, at least for me personally. During that time, they dropped the N. So I went from WN to CCM, to WA to CCM, and they made novice renewable. And they made it I think it was a 5-year term back then or something.
And did you renew it more than once?
Yes.
You went the 5 years as a novice and then renewed it again?
I've been a ham radio operator continuously since I, well, although that little small break of a month or whatever in between the first novice. But yeah, I was a novice for 10 years. During that time, I, you know, graduated high school and all and went into the military. My first duty assignment was Sembach Air Base, Germany. The interesting problem with that is there was no reciprocity in Germany for a novice operator. You had to be at least a technician. And so that motivated me because I wanted to operate. And so I had to wait until a FCC field examiner came to an airbase close to me that I could get to, And I went before the FCC field examiner and upgraded to technician. And that way I was able to apply for my German call sign, DA4GR. And I operated there for a little less than 2 years because it took me a while to get the license and everything.
So let's go back just a little bit.
Sure.
You said your father, his vocation, he worked in the factory, but his avocation was he worked in electronics. Did he have an electronics workbench or anything like that at your house?
Oh, my. Yes. Workbench would be an understatement. He ended up taking over the entire dining room. What that actually ended up, he built a lot of Heathkit equipment. In fact, the first station that I operated was an SB-303 with an Apache transmitter. He later upgraded the transmitter to an SB-401, and those, of course, he all built himself. And he started building Heathkit test equipment. He had an O-scope, a frequency counter, signal generator, the whole nine yards. And he studied and got a second-class radio telephone license. And so this was during mid-70s to late 70s during the CB craze. So he had a friend that was in the CB repair business, and that guy was just overwhelmed. So he decided he would start CB repair business on the side. And so he did, and he was pretty good at it. Now, what was interesting was I was a 15, 16-year-old kid, and people would be amazed because I'd be the one going out and checking the SWR and the antennas, and I did some radio installation and antenna installations and things like that for my dad. And, you know, because my dad put a lot of money into the test equipment and everything, he didn't pay me, but the agreement was I could keep any tips I got. And believe it or not, I actually got some pretty good tips sometimes because people were just impressed that a, you know, teenager could do all this stuff. But what ended up happening was it even got more interesting because the factory my dad worked at closed and he was laid off. And so he ended up having to go on the road fixing machines, you know, all over the United States to, you know, keep the money coming into the family. Well, I ended up taking over the CB repair business and doing the repairs and stuff, you know, and he would call a few times a week. And if I had a problem with a particular radio, you know, like, here's what's going on, here's what I've done and everything. And he'd give me advice on what to try next or whatever to do. And I was able to keep the business running. And we did pretty well until he ended up finally moving to South Carolina to take a more permanent job that was working for one of the counties in South Carolina, taking care of their voting machines.
The CB radio business wasn't family sustaining. Didn't have that much.
No, it didn't have. It was a side gig, but you know, how much he actually made on it, I don't know. But it did help quite a bit because, you know, his income was a bit sporadic once the factory closed. So I'm sure that actually helped put on food on the table quite more than I probably even realized at the time.
So did ham radio play a part then in the choices that you made for your career and education? What did you do after high school?
My dad, like I said, he had to move to South Carolina, and this was during my senior year in high school. And of course, you know, I didn't want to move during my senior year. So my eldest brother was, you know, living in the same village that we were in. So he, you know, agreed to let me stay with him to finish out high school. So I actually accelerated my high school career. I graduated halfway through my senior year. I had all the credits and everything. And then I ended up going into the United States Air Force at the young age of 17 and made that my career. I made some mistakes, though, with the recruiter, which, you know, most people will tell you this story because I didn't have a guaranteed job when I went in there. Now, the recruiter told me, oh, don't worry about that. You can just go in on this general thing. And when you get to basic training, they'll provide counseling to you and you know, show you what jobs are available, and you can choose whatever job you want. Yeah. The way that actually worked out was the technical instructor, he threw some papers at me and said, here, pick a job. So it didn't work out quite the way I expected. And I chose what I knew something about, and I knew I could do. I went into what was called ground radio maintenance. So Yes, ham radio did have an effect on that, but if you look at my career later on, I abandoned that career fairly soon in my military career because of some special equipment identifiers that they gave to me.
So what is ground radio maintenance then, as far as the Air Force is concerned? It means that you weren't working on avionics.
Well, yes and no. And that's part of the story of why I didn't stay in it long. Ground radio is traditionally, it's the radios that would be like in a control tower on an Air Force base that talk to the aircraft. However, there's other places that ground radio is used because they're kind of the general radio technicians of the Air Force, if you will. We worked on just about anything. So when I actually went to my first duty station, I actually worked for, well, it was a movable control aircraft control system. It was mobile, so we could actually move. It was not, you know, easily movable. It was, you know, pretty big. And I actually worked at a site that was off the Air Force base where we were set up there. And I worked on UHF, VHF primarily, that talked to the aircraft, although we did have some HF that they did have there. There were two things that made me disheartened with radio maintenance in the Air Force. The first was I was a little jaded because I came from working on CB radios and I was doing discrete component repair. You know, I was replacing transistors, resistors, you know, whatever needed to be done. In the Air Force, it wasn't quite that way. Most of that was more modular replacement. You know, you pull out a circuit card and replace it, and then you send the circuit card off to what they called depot level maintenance, where they would actually do the discrete component repair and stuff like that. And the other thing, I don't agree with this method, but this is the way the Air Force does it, because they have this thing called preventive maintenance they do on radios. And this is supposed to keep the radios in tip-top shape, you know, and make sure everything's adjusted right and working properly. And you do this, you know, at certain periods, you know, that are specified in the technical manuals. But I'm more of a guy, if it works, don't fix it. Because I'll tell you, just from my experience in working in the Air Force, I probably broke more radios during preventive maintenance than I ever, you know, worked on that it broke from other reasons.
But wasn't that maybe just to keep people busy?
That could very well be why they do that. Because idle hands, yeah, that could very well be part of it, yes.
You're in Germany doing this job.
Right, that was my first duty station. I was there for 2 years.
And what kind of ham radio were you doing? You say you got yourself a German amateur radio license, DA4GR.
Right.
What did you discover about ham radio operation in Germany?
Well, it was fun because I did take a couple years of German in high school, so I did have a little bit of German. I wasn't, you know, fully conversant in it, but it was fun to be able to talk to the local hams, and I did go to some of the local clubs. My first personal radio station, I had a Yaesu FT-101E. That was my first personal loan, too. I took out a loan for, you know, like $350 to purchase that radio, you know. I also had a Drake TR-22.
Remember that. That was the Luggy Talkie on 2 meters.
Yes, it was fun. I had fun with that. Yeah, until my whip broke. But there's another story with that if you want to get to that at some point. And I also had a Midland 13505. That made up my first station.
And the 13505 was what band? Was that 220?
That was a 2 meter as well. That was a mobile radio that I used as a base station.
I remember some of those stations. Midland was one of the few companies in those days that would venture into the 220 megahertz FM band.
Yes.
There weren't a lot of other players in those days.
Right.
Okay, so what happened after that? So you spent 2 years in Germany working on that. Where did you go after that?
After that, that's where the decisions to change my career path in the Air Force began. I was originally given an assignment to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and that was like a dream for a single guy coming back to the United States after 2 years. I was so excited until I got this little notice from my personnel office that you have been diverted to Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Now, I'm Air Force. This is an Army base. 40,000 Army personnel. I'll use it nicely because I usually say it a little differently to my Army friends, but I'll be nice to you on here. And there were about 100 Air Force people there. I was actually officially attached to the 101st Airborne Air Assault. I actually wore the Screaming Eagle. Again, I have to change my mindset because I use different terms normally when I'm talking to people. I was a Black Beret. I was radio maintenance that supported the forward air controllers that supported the 101st Airborne when they went out on their deployment.
Just to remind the listeners, the 101st Airborne, that was a special ops unit.
Yeah, they're similar but different. Normally you think of like the 82nd Airborne, they fall out of air perfectly operational aircraft with these parachute things. Now, the 101st Airborne, they're a little bit different mission because they don't actually jump out of aircraft. They jump out of helicopters. They basically zip line off of the helicopters and then go in. But they do special insertions even behind enemy lines and such. And the people that I helped were the what were called forward air controllers. They would help direct air cover for these guys when they went in and provided air support.
So did that mean that you actually went on missions?
Well, fortunately, while I was there, I did some training with them, but I never actually deployed with them. But yes, that's what I would have been doing.
Potentially, you could have gone on missions with them.
Potentially, I could have, yes.
Wow.
So, yes. And see, that the reason I got the change of assignment was because, you know, my personnel office, they gave me this, what's called a special equipment identifier. And the special equipment identifier was for mobile TACs, which meant that I was doomed in my career to work in these types of environments the rest of my Air Force career. And I'm like, I'm Air Force. I really didn't sign up to be in the Army, so I'm not doing this anymore.
So how did that work out for you? I mean, did you spend your entire career in the Air Force?
I did. I did 22 and a half years. I retired as a Chief Master Sergeant in the Air Force, which an achievement, I believe.
How about that? I think that's amazing.
Less than 1% of the enlisted force achieved that rank, so by mandate of Congress. So,
okay, and so where did you end up?
Well, during my time in Germany and my time even in Fort Campbell, I was interested in the nuclear, biological, chemical parts of the Air Force, teaching that NBC defense. And so I thought, hey, this would be a great career field for me to train into. At that time, it was called disaster preparedness. It's now called emergency management. Not knowing much about the career field, and because I was on an Army base, I was unable to do some of the things that were technically required for me to cross-train into this. Because when you're in your first duty assignment and you're approved to, or first enlistment, I mean, and you're approved to continue your career, they do have make it easier for you to change careers if you want to. And so I went through that process. What I found out later was the career I went into was not the greatest career field that I could possibly have chosen because there were some issues. You could only cross-train into this career field. There were some issues with advancement in that career field, but I was able to make it work for me. And it kind of, you know, you asked if amateur radio had a impact on it. You know, it does too, because I've, in my amateur radio career, if you will, I've done a lot of emergency communications there as well, which is part of what we did in disaster preparedness. We did command and control for major accident response. You know, I did command and control for several aircraft accidents and things of that nature through military-affiliated radio. When I was in Germany, I did provide emergency communications for a explosive incident. There were some explosives that were not supposed to be in a device that was sent off to be basically crushed and
recycled,
and it ended up blowing up.
I mean, you're saying they forgot to take the explosive part out of whatever it was that was supposed to be recycled.
Yeah. Yeah, there were some people that got in some pretty big trouble over that, yes. But I provided support through that, through the military-affiliated radio system. So
you have to love the language used. in order to explain things to the general population.
Yes.
You spent 22 years in the military, and I think it was largely during peacetime, I would think. It was post-Vietnam, right?
For the most part, yes. I was there during, I was again back in Germany during Desert Shield and Desert Storm. I did have troops that did go forward with that. They kept me back to take care of stuff where I was at. I was stationed at Bitburg at that time. I actually closed that Air Force base. They closed that during the drawdown. But yeah, it was predominantly peacetime. I did deploy for the Bosnia-Herzegovina deal. I went to Hungary for that for a short period.
So you got to do a little bit of traveling.
Yes. I moved on average every 2 years in the Air Force, so I moved around a lot.
Were you active in ham radio all that time?
For the most part, yes. The only time I was not active in ham radio, and I still used MARS, I did have a remote assignment to Korea, and I didn't operate then other than doing MARS calls back to my wife. But that was the only time that I wasn't active in some way, you know. And it's ebbed and flowed, you know. Sometimes I've been more active than others, but I've always had my hands into ham radio in some way, shape, or form.
Your wife, did she have an interest in amateur radio?
Absolutely not. In fact, we almost got divorced over it.
It's not the first time I've heard that.
Well, I'll tell you the story. It's kind of a funny story. During my remote assignment in Korea, she stayed at Myrtle Beach. I actually got to Myrtle Beach eventually. I met my wife at Fort Campbell, so that was the one good thing that did come out of that assignment. But we were stationed at Myrtle Beach, and then I went to Korea. And while I was there, she decided to clean out a closet. Now, this closet contained all my QSTs, all my QSL cards, all my logbooks, all of that stuff. And, of course, to her, this was meaningless. Now, to me, I actually printed all my QSL cards in shop in high school, all my logbooks I printed, and all this, you know. So this had some nostalgia to me.
To you, it looked like passive aggression.
Yes.
That's why men are from Mars and women are from Venus.
So when I found out she did that, ooh, I was a bit hot. But we've been happily married now for over 41 years, so.
And she's apologized for the mix-up, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I have to say this. She's never tried to, you know, curtail my ham radio career or anything like that. You know, one of the first rules is no HOAs when buying a house, and antennas will go up.
And have you been successful? Because I hear from people in the States that HOAs are the norm, not the exception.
It's hard sometimes. I've been fortunate, you know, because I set, you know, and I live in Panama City, Florida. So when I moved here, it was towards the end of my military career. So we decided we were going to put down roots here, although I did end up having one more assignment away, and we had to rent out our house for a bit that we had. But I used a three pigs principle of house buying as well here, because we have these things called hurricanes that come along every once in a while and, you know, huff and puff and try to blow your house down. So I did have standards, you know, it was going to be a brick home, not in a flood zone, and no HOAs. So those are kind of the restrictions that I had.
That's the three pigs.
Yeah. Yes. Right. But in that actually helped, because not long ago we went through Hurricane Michael, and it was, boy, I tell you what, riding out a hurricane, a Cat 5 hurricane, is not something I would recommend, even if you follow the three pigs principle. In fact, we ended up eventually selling that home, and we're in a different home now, but that's also because we're getting older, and that was a three-story house, and the one we're in now is all on one level, so, and we're out in the country a little bit more, too. So,
and now this mid-show break. The future of podcasting and the QSO Today podcast is listener sponsorship. It keeps us lean and focused on providing you the best ham radio interviews since 2014. You can keep the QSO Today podcast commercial and sponsor-free by becoming a listener sponsor yourself. For $10 a month or save 20% at $100 per year, you can become a listener sponsor. I am now recording the QSO Today podcast as video interviews that are available only as a benefit to listener sponsors through our QSO Today community website. As I develop the sponsorship tier, I will add bonus content for listener sponsors. Listener sponsors, not donors, are automatically members of the new QSO Today Academy. I am building the Academy website to include access to our SQLIO networking lounges all of the time and Academy resources including over 400 previous expo presentations with Q&A and additional helpful ham radio educational resources. The benefit of listener sponsorship as an alternative to commercial sponsorship is that commercial sponsors influence the content and comments in the podcast. Listener sponsorship allows a greater degree of freedom to discuss any ham radio subject without commercial consequence. I have eliminated all commercials in the QSO Today podcast from episode 445, with the exception of the Ham Radio Workbench podcast, as I think that this is a serious asset to a well-rounded ham radio education. I am not using Buy Me a Coffee or Patreon, but my own system for managing the community that could form out of the podcast. I direct you to the sponsorship section of the show notes pages beginning with the episode 444, where I list all of the contributors to the podcast since 2014, including sponsors, donors, and hams who have paid for transcriptions. If sponsorship is not your interest, then you can make any size donation to the podcast by clicking on the donation button on the QSO Today podcast website at qsotoday.com. There is a slider that you can use to adjust the amount of your donation. If you want to make your donation monthly, click on the recurring donation box. It is the recurring donations and the listener sponsorships that keep the lights burning here. Finally, you don't have to contribute anything to listen to the QSO Today podcast. You can use my Amazon affiliate link before shopping at Amazon by clicking on it on the right side of the show notes page. This will signal Amazon to send us a small percentage of what you purchase. This is the most painless way to ensure that the QSO Today project will be here next week. I want to thank everyone who has contributed and will contribute to my effort to create this oral history of amateur radio since 2014. It will eventually all be in the public domain for hams in the future to enjoy. Be sure to become a listener sponsor or make a donation today. And now we return to our QSO Today.
So share this a little bit with the listeners. I've had Greg on, N4KGL, who's also from Panama City. I don't think we ever got into it, but people that live in the Gulf region or along the Florida coast, they get these hurricanes, and some suffer from them, and sometimes it just jumps over them. What do people do for those of us who are in the hills or in the areas where there's no tornadoes or hurricanes? I grew up in California. I think we were worried about
earthquakes, yeah.
And there wasn't a lot where you could run from those. But if you're living in Panama City, what are you looking for in terms of a place where you could actually stay during a hurricane? Or does that not happen? People don't stay in the area when there's a hurricane that could land on them.
Well, like I said, we rode it out. Now, that was not necessarily a full intentional decision on our part. The way this played out, I was actually working civil service for the Navy at the time, so I'm kind of a traitor because I'm retired Navy civil service as well. But we had just come up from Central Florida. We had a son living down there, and we were visiting him, and it was holiday weekend just prior to the storm. And so we came up, and we knew the storm was coming. But at that time, it was just a tropical storm and was not even projected to be much more. And as we were coming back, it was looking like maybe a Category 1 or 2, which if you live around hurricanes, a Category 1 and 2, you don't even pay attention to them, really. I mean, yeah, you do a few things, you know, make sure nothing's loose out in your yard and, you know, things like that. But there's not really much preparation you do. The problem with Hurricane Michael is it went from a 2 to a 5 in a matter of hours. This thing ramped up so quickly. And because I was working with the Navy, they authorized the evacuation of certain zones. And within this, we have evacuation zones, and we had A, B, C, and D. We were actually in D. So they told us, it's not going to be that bad. You don't need to evacuate. And so I was basically following the Navy's guidance, and I'm like, yeah, we can ride this out. You know, because we were fairly well prepared. You know, I have a brick home, had a metal roof, and, you know, hurricane clips and all the stuff that, you know, makes the house as safe as you can.
When you say clips, it means something to hold the roof on so that the pressure under the roof doesn't take the roof away?
Yes, it holds the roof to the structure of the house so that it doesn't blow off, which many of them did here. By the time we realized that this thing was going to be, in fact, they only called it a Category 4 at the time. It was not until post-storm that they actually upgraded it to a 5 because of other indications of how high the wind speeds were. It was too late for us to evacuate at that point, because there comes a point where, you know, you don't want to evacuate and be stuck out in the open in your car when this thing comes. You know, you're much better off being, you know, within your house. So that's what we did. And we were fairly well prepared. I mean, I had a generator for electricity. We actually had a irrigation well with a hand pump that we could get water. Now, this was not necessarily potable water. But we also had a 55-gallon drum that we did fill prior to the storm landfall with water, which was potable water. And I even had a portable air conditioner that would work off my generator. So we were fairly well prepared, so I thought. But we're talking a Category 5 storm here. As we were riding the storm out, we were in our living room, which was pretty much the safest room in the house. I tell you what. Hearing the trees fall all around the house, we were extremely fortunate. And the only explanation I can give is Yahweh was watching out for us.
That's a good explanation.
I'm serious, because all the trees fell around our house, but not on it. And we had windows blow out in our master bedroom. And, you know, I mean, it was...
Here in Israel, I live in a place that we get rockets. So I have a bomb shelter in my house, and my bomb shelter is actually on the third floor, because when Saddam Hussein during the first Gulf War was sending Scud missiles into Israel, they were worried about poison gas. So the building code here was to build the bomb shelters not in the basement, but up on the upper floors in case the gas settled, right? So we create opportunities for protection. In Panama City, do you actually have a shelter in your house, even though your house is made of brick, so that if the whole house came down on you, that you'd still be safe in there? Or do people not go into root cellars or something like that because they could flood from water? I mean, how does that work there?
We don't have cellars in this area because our water table is so high, at least for the most part. We basically follow the typical things that you would follow for example, for tornadoes, you know, they'll tell you to go to a windowless room that's a small room, typically a bathroom that, you know, has the walls, you know, close by and provide some structural support for you.
So like they're bearing walls.
Yes. Yeah, load bearing. Right. So we didn't actually do that. Our living room was centrally located, and it was fairly good. I mean, we did have some French doors, but we also had a screen room off of that. So luckily, our doors didn't give us any problems. I know a lot of people, their doors failed and caused problems with intrusion and such. But we were very fortunate. And I'll tell you, afterwards, that was interesting, because I was lucky. I was on one of two cell phone carriers that still had some connectivity. You couldn't get a call through, of course, because the system was just overwhelmed.
Right, because all your power lines are above ground.
Oh, yes. Power was gone. We were out of power for about 6 weeks, maybe more. It might have even been a little bit longer than that.
But you could use your generator.
Right, right. Keep the refrigerator going and things like that. And
so you're camping for 6 weeks.
Right. In my grill actually survived, my propane grill, so we were able to use that and, And we cooked for the neighborhood for a while, some of our stuff, you know. And but I was able to get text messages out. And fortunately, I was able to, you know, text my daughter who lives in North Carolina. And the first text I sent her is just safe. You know, that's all I sent. Boom. You know, because I knew she'd be worried about us and everything. And then I actually ended up using her to coordinate because I work for the Navy and they expanded the evacuation order. I found out after a few days, I was actually able to get my wife and our puppies to Pensacola to a lodging area there on the Naval Station until, you know, things got a little bit better where we could be a little more comfortable. Because being without air conditioning in Florida in October, you might think, oh, that shouldn't be a problem. Oh, yeah, it is.
I'm curious, does the grade of hurricane goes from a 3 to a 4, does that also affect like insurance reimbursement or anything like that?
Not directly. I mean, the insurance is based on what damage you incur. Of course, the damage is in relation to how bad the storm is. Michael actually was more of a wind event than it was a rain and flood or surge event, because storm surge actually with hurricanes is more of a problem than the winds in many cases. But in this case, the winds, you know, there were winds in excess of 200 miles an hour in some areas. So it was significant.
So a storm surge is the amount of moisture that the storm itself is carrying in the air.
The storm surge is actually the water coming up from the ocean. It's kind of like a tsunami, if you will. And in a way, it's the amount of surf that's pushed up onto shore from the winds of the storm.
What's so amazing is how infinitely adaptable human beings are to the environment that we're in. I figure if people could live in South Carolina, they could live anywhere. Now, I'm only saying that from having been in South Carolina once during August and thinking this is the hottest place on earth I've ever been. And I could only appreciate the people that live in South Carolina as a result of having been there during August. Okay, well, this is very interesting. Were you able to use your ham radio in the aftermath of Hurricane Michael in order to be able to get the word out once things settled down?
I didn't really use ham radio much, and this is not atypical, because when you're in the area affected, you're not expected to, and usually not called, because you got more important irons in the fire. Now, I did throw on the handy talkie, you know, just to listen here and there, but I didn't use it for anything as far as getting emergency messages out or anything like that, because typically in these situations, you have jump teams that'll come in and provide the support to the affected area, and that's really the best way to do it, because people that are there, they're taking care of, you know, life and limb of their own, you know, property and stuff like that.
They're preoccupied.
Yes.
Let's go back into your ham radio. I'm curious. I got the impression that you become quite the CW operator as a person who wasn't doing CW before.
Well, when I tell people this story, I tell them that I owe my extra class to my father. Because when I got my extra class, I got it the old-fashioned way, back when you had to have 20 words per minute. And this was when I was stationed in Washington, D.C. at the time, and I decided that I was tired of being a technician and I wanted to upgrade. And, of course, you know, the theory and stuff was no big deal for me. You know, I could do that all day long. The code was my nemesis. And so where I was stationed there, they had a little pole in my shed. I think they used to use it for like one of those little things that you hold, put laundry on or something. But it was just a little stick that came up out of the area by my shed. And it was just perfect to mount an 18 AVQ vertical on. So I was able to put that on there, and I was able to get on the air with my dad. And we got on CW, and we did this for, I don't know, 3 or 4 months. We were on the air pretty much daily. And, you know, as we were going along, of course, I was getting better at my CW, and I was getting ready to go take my exam. And I asked my dad, how fast are you sending to me? And he said, oh, about 15. And I'm like, great, I'll be able to do 13, no problem. Got a little bit of buffer there. So I went to the examination and I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to listen to 20 just to calm my nerves and just, you know, get used to listening to CW. And they begin the practice portion and I start copying it and I copy the practice portion solid copy. I'm like, okay, game on. Turn my paper over and I start copying. And I probably got about 3 minutes of solid copy, and then, you know, it started faltering off because I was getting tired and everything. But long and short of it is I was able to copy the 20 word per minute and pass 20 words per minute. So I was able to get my extra class a few months later. You know, I wasn't quite ready to do all the theory at once, but within like 3 months, I upgraded to extra. But the interesting thing is after I passed the exam, I got on the phone to my dad and I said, Dad, how fast were you really sending to me? He said, eh, probably around 19. And I'm like, And he told me that he had a mentor that had done that, or Elmer, that had done that to him early in his ham career and stuff. So now I can't copy 20 words per minute now. I have to admit I haven't kept up my CW. I'm probably down around 10-ish or so, but that is one of my goals, is to hopefully get my speed back up and be able to operate more CW. Because when I did get up to that speed, CW was actually starting to be enjoyable to me and such. So I do want to get back to that at some point.
Are you doing RADAR, Rapid Deployment Amateur Radio, in Panama City? Because I know that Greg's a big advocate.
Greg has done that. I have not done that. I do pretty much at least once a year I go out with Greg. He's a good buddy of mine. We used to work at the Navy base together. That's how we kind of got to know each other. Other than ham radio, we knew each other there, but we became good friends there. But I do usually go to ARL Field Day with him wherever he's at. I usually go there and camp out with him and do Field Day with him. And every once in a while, we'll get together and do some other things. But I've also done some of the rocketry stuff with him. I don't remember if you talked to him about that during your podcast, but he's into rocketry big time, and that's fun.
We're not talking like little bottle rockets. We're talking about rockets that are 9 feet long or something.
Yeah, we're talking rockets you have to be certified to fly. There's a certification process that's actually three-tiered, I believe. There's one, two, and three that for the size of the motors and stuff, you have to be authorized. And I never got to that level. I just did the kiddie ones, you know, and I had some kids that I was mentoring and stuff that I'd take launch rockets with and stuff. And my kids did that when they were kids, too. I enjoyed it.
Right. I think he has to file a flight plan when he shoots off his rockets, right?
Where they're at, they actually have an FAA clearance for, I think, 10,000 feet. Yeah, they have to actually have clearance for their flight area that they're in because, yeah, they go up about a mile.
I'll put Greg's episode link in the show notes page this week so that people can go there as well and find out. So what is your favorite operating mode now then?
Pretty much I'm a voice guy, operate voice predominantly. I have dabbled a little bit in the past in some digital modes, and I'd like to eventually get back to that. And like I said, I want to eventually get my CW skills back up again and do that, but primarily I'm voice.
I want to take a minute to tell you about my favorite podcast, the Ham Radio Workbench Podcast, with George, KJ6VU, and now joined by Rod, VA3ON, Mike, VA3MW, Mark, N6MTS, and Vince, VE6LK. Every 2 weeks, George and company offer up a status report on the many amateur radio projects on their workbenches and explore projects on their guests' workbenches. This group is project active and prolific, covering many technical areas of amateur radio. So the next time you want a deep dive into ham radio electronic project building, or to learn about technology, tools, test equipment, construction techniques, and the rest, listen to the Ham Radio Workbench Podcast, available on every podcast player and channel. Use the link in this week's show notes page to get to the Ham Radio Workbench Podcast directly. And now back to my QSO. Do you have an amateur radio workbench?
Not really. I have done stuff before, like I built an Elcraft K2. I really enjoyed that, and I've built, you know, several Heath kits over the years and things like that. But right now, It's not because I don't enjoy that. It's just I don't have the time to do. But pretty much right now I'm just an appliance operator, but I would like to do some projects in the future sometime.
What appliances are you operating?
I have a Elecraft KPA 100 is my HF rig, and then I've got an ICOM, I think it's a 880H, I think it is, D-Star 2-meter, and that's my primary station. I've got a few handy talkies and stuff as well. But
do you operate DMR?
I do. Just started, actually. I've got a little DMR handy talkie, and we've got a DMR repeater they just brought online here in concert with the local club, and I just started messing with that. Haven't actually made a DMR contact yet, but I have heard signals on DMR, so I was having a little trouble at first getting the code plug set up properly, but I think I've got that right now, so starting to work on it.
So what is the Flying Pigs QRP Club?
That's just one of the clubs out there that they're QRPers, and they just have different contests here and there, and it's just one of them that I signed up for. I was operating QRP for quite some time when I built my K2. That's all the choice I had. Only had up to 15 watts, but during the peak cycles, that's all you need. In fact, one of my most memorable contacts, and this may have even been the contact that I got the Rag Chewers award with my dad. He was up in New York. I was in Texas at the time, if I recall. And we were on 15 meters, and we were actually going K2 to K2. And I was able to turn the power all the way down. I think the lowest power is like 200 milliwatts. We were still S5, S6 signals. And that was just a blast for me to be able to talk on that little bit, you know, back to my dad in New York. Just very enjoyable cue. So, and I love 10 meters too when it's open.
What excites you the most about what's happening right now in amateur radio?
What I love about amateur radio is it's so broad, and there's so many different technologies coming in. You know, you've got your, FT8 and, you know, all these different digital modes that are coming along, and just so many different facets that people are coming up with to communicate. It just makes it exciting, because if you get bored doing something in ham radio, it's like, just try something new, you know, and there's so many different things you can do. I've just touched the surface of it, you know. As far as digital, I've pretty much just done packet and a little bit of, AmTOR and stuff like that. But, I have operated FT8, but that was during field day with Greg and using his equipment and stuff. But I haven't set it up in my own station. But those are things I enjoy doing, is, you know, trying different things here and there. Like, that's why I'm playing around with DMR right now. It's a different mode and something different to do.
And so it's the variety of that. Is there something that we could be doing better to attract other people into amateur radio? Are you involved in any outreach from the amateur radio community to the outside world?
Not directly myself, but, you know, one of the things that I think we have to understand when we're trying to increase our ranks, if you will, you know, a lot of people will focus on the youth, and I'm not saying that's wrong. I mean, yes, do that, because, you know, I'm glad I was able to become a ham radio operator early, you know, and I know there's people that did it even earlier than me in their lives, but it's good to do that. I know you've got a child you're mentoring now that trying to get him interested in ham radio and such, and that's great. But, you know, in reality, most people come to ham radio in their mid to late 30s, you know, once they're established in their families and stuff, and they've got a little bit of discretionary income that they can, you know, put into ham radio and things like that. And also, there's people that towards the end of their careers and stuff, you know, they're retiring, they're looking for a hobby to do, And, you know, amateur radio is a great thing to do. And so I think we need to be looking across the whole spectrum of people's lives, because amateur radio can fit in a lot of different ways, depending on how someone, you know, wants to, you know, use it in their lives. Ham radio is not just a technology. To me, it's a way of life. I mean, in a way, because it's had an impact on my life in some way, shape, or form throughout my entire life.
I'd love to do a study or find a study, and I'm sure that maybe somebody's done a study, or maybe we should find somebody who's got an ARRL scholarship to college who might be studying, I don't know, sociology or something like that, in terms of whether amateur radio operators live longer because they're connected to community, they're connected to other people. My father will be 94 here in another month or so, and I see that he no longer has connections to people outside of his home, which is my brother. But then when I meet hams who are in their 80s, they're always talking to their friends. They've got these social connections going. And I'm wondering whether or not, in fact, ham radio is good for old people in terms of keeping them active.
That's one of the beautiful things of some of the technologies that we have now, because I know my father, towards the end of his life, he was in a VA nursing home, and so his ability to operate ham radio was basically restricted to a handy talkie, which wasn't much use to him there. But now with the technologies we have, the whole world is open to you because of remote radio and hotspots and stuff. So you can still keep that connection. And so that's what's beautiful about it, you know, because I hope to be doing ham radio until the day I die, you know. And, you know, if I end up having to go to a nursing home, I'm hoping that those technologies are there for me that I can keep doing, you know, because there's been times when I haven't had a station up and I've used, you know, EchoLink or something like that to keep in touch with friends and family and such like that. So it's wonderful.
Now, one of the things I want to touch on before we go, you're now retired, although you don't look old enough to necessarily be retired, but you're standing in front of two oil paintings of, it looks to me like, the Constitutional Conventions in Philadelphia.
Constitutional Convention and the Declaration, right.
It's my understanding that you're now the producer of your own podcast, or you're podcasting with a partner, called The Road to Concord. Even though the pictures are Pennsylvania and not Massachusetts, can you talk a little bit about what the Road to Concord podcast is? And I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well.
Sure. The Road to Concord, I've got a friend, Joe Bakanovic. He's the main talking head, if you will, for the show. But we cover, of course, the Founding Fathers, as you can see here. We cover current events, conspiracy theories. You know, we do that for fun. And we also cover biblical topics. And all of this is actually through a biblical worldview. We take real-world events and such and explain them through the lens of the Bible and try to explain how these things interact and how they can be meaningful in your life. And it's fun. I'm the producer. I handle mostly, you know, handle the chats and such like that, some of the technical background stuff. But he does on occasion throw me on the screen and use me. I am a biblical Hebrew scholar. I've been studying biblical Hebrew for 5 years. So if he's got something that applies to that, he will quickly throw me on the screen to discuss a word or how it's looked at through the Hebraic perspective and such.
And are you doing your own video editing, or are you take it right off the reel and put it up?
We actually stream live, and then it's archived through the different streaming services. I do a little bit of editing, and I'm probably going to end up doing more, because one of the things we want to do is develop some YouTube shorts or something that we could throw onto like TikTok and stuff for, you know, teaching logic and other things that we do. We're set up as a classroom environment. It's not just a, you know, political talk show or anything. It's more of a teaching environment.
Well, I think that sounds like a lot of fun. I mean, as a person that's done your episode 484, I realize that it can snowball into a much larger thing, so I wish you nothing but luck with your podcast.
And I've even taken some of your ideas as far as how you're funding your program. We don't have any commercial sponsors or anything. We're all just donation-based as well, so... And I know you've went that way, and I know it's probably kind of tricky for you and tough, but I think you've got a bigger audience than we do right now, and, you know, eventually maybe we'll grow with the fans, I'm sure.
It took a long time, Rick, but I'll tell you something, just so that you know this. This value-for-value model was actually created by Adam Curry, who's also a ham radio operator, for the podcasts that they do. And for the listeners out there, most of the podcasts that were commercially based are dying off. So it ended up not being a great revenue model for the podcast industry. Yeah.
And like you say in your little blurb on it, you know, you're limited when you have commercial sponsorship because you can't say certain things because you don't want to offend your, you know, the hand that feeds you and so on. And some of the topics that we cover on our podcast, there's a lot of commercial sponsors that would not be happy with some of the things that we cover.
Again, this is one of the reasons I'm mentioning your podcast. Not only can you learn a lot from looking at different podcasts, but they're also entertaining. They're thought stimulating. Like a good book, if they're worth coming back to week after week, then they're worth supporting.
Right.
Not tooting my own horn here, but as you're finding out, as you're getting into production, it ain't cheap necessarily.
Oh, it's not. But you know, I really appreciate what you're doing for the amateur radio community because, you know, I look at, you know, all the interviews that you've done and, you know, unfortunately, there's many of those that you've interviewed that are silent keys now. But now you've been able to capture their stories that will be around forever now. And that is so valuable to the community, in my opinion, because that's, to me, that's what ham radio is. It's a community. It's a, like I said, it's a lifestyle. If you allow it, it will permeate your entire life. You know, I'm not saying that, you know, everything I do is ham radio, but it's had a large impact on my life. And I know one of the questions that you like to ask, and hopefully I'm not going too far ahead, but, you know, what do you do for a new ham or returning ham? And, you know, I thought a lot about that question because I've listened to, you know, except I think I've got, like, I'm beginning maybe three or four of your podcasts that I haven't heard recently that you put out, but, you know, I've thought about it. You know, everybody says, you know, well, pick a mode you like and things like that. And, you know, find your focus and join a club and things like that. And those are good. But I was thinking about it and just recently, you know, preparing for this show, I thought, you know, to me, and this is something that I've tried to do my entire ham radio career, is what do you do for the ham radio community? And, you know, when I you know, sent you a message and said, you know, you can interview me if you want, but I'm just a, you know, plain old ham radio operator. You know, I'm not one of the famous guys, you know, have done some great papers or done some great projects or anything. I haven't done that, but I have given back to ham radio throughout my entire ham radio career. I've done different things. You know, I've been a volunteer examiner. I'm still technically one, but I don't do it as much as I used to because it used to be a big deal because there weren't as many extra class radio amateurs because of the code requirement, I believe, you know, and you could debate that all day long, whether that was good or bad. But I've also done emergency communications. I'm a member of the Amateur Radio Emergency Service here in Bay County, not as active as I used to be, but I still keep my fingers in that. And different things, mentoring people, you know, and so I think that that's part of it. You know, I've served as a club officer, you know, things like that. I think if you want to really, you know, become a real ham radio operator, you need to do those kind of things as well, because that kind of integrates you more into the community, and you feel more of a part of it than just, you know, talking on the radio to some stranger that, you know, which, you know, is great too. I enjoy that, but it helps you to build that community and feel connected. And I think that's important.
I've written about Akiva on my blog. Akiva is the 9-year-old who comes to me every week. Actually, he'll be here in another hour because it's his day. But one of the things that that's done, I mean, I've been a ham for 50 years now. One of those things that that has done is it's made me get out the books and remember, you know, Kirchhoff's law, you know, so we're dividing up current on branches in a circuit. And it's really caused me to have to go back and be able to articulate to a 9-year-old. He happens to be a very bright little 9-year-old, but a 9-year-old, what this stuff is, why it's important, how it works, even going back into doing algebra or doing long division. I mean, I've had to learn how to do long division over in preparation for him coming because I have this belief that every kid needs to learn with a pencil. I'll tell him, I'll say, look, you're going to be a rocket scientist. You're planning a trajectory to Mars. If you know how the math works, if you're looking at the end result that you've built this trajectory and there's something about it that bothers you, the reason it bothers you is because of what you learned. And you'll go back and you'll make sure that you're not sending the thing to Venus instead of Mars. And he looks at me and goes, oh yeah, that makes sense. I feel like, oh yes, I feel like I'm giving back. So it's remarkable when you're sharing something that you're so passionate about, and I've been passionate about it for 50 years, with someone else, especially if you're sharing it with somebody who's never heard of it, and his parents and his grandparents, whoever picks him up, his siblings. It's remarkable. I'm with you 100% that if you really want to dig in there and pull out the stuff that you thought you forgot, get yourself a kid with the help of their parents or something to start trying to recreate that whole thing that you went through when you were that age. There's nothing like it.
I remember back when one of the greatest gifts my parents ever gave me was one of those Radio Shack, what was it, 101 electronic kits with the little spring things in it, yeah. And oh man, I made every project in that book, and then I started making my own. And fortunately for me, because my dad was a tinkerer, he had a stock of parts and stuff, because I'd blow transistors all over the place and everything. So I'd just go into his box, pull out a 2N2222 and throw it back in there and start off again and making different things. And I just enjoyed the heck out of that stuff. And
what's interesting, Akiva, when he first started coming to me, brought one of these kits, but it's the 2022 version.
Right, right.
Every single project that we've done out of that, what we'll do is we'll breadboard it, and then I'll figure out some kind of construction technique, whether it's dead bug or something like that, so that he has different ways of putting it together. But all the silicon in his kit, it's all bad. It's like it's floor scrapings. Why isn't this working? I measure all the voltages with him, and why is it not working? And then I go replace the transistors with transistors from my set, from my stock, and all of a sudden it starts working. And I'm thinking, you know, this could be very frustrating for kids that are getting these kits and they're trying to build this stuff and it doesn't work. And they don't have anybody around them that says, well, wait a second, there's something, all the voltages seem right. Why is this thing not working? So far, I've replaced maybe 6 out of 6 transistors in 3 projects so far.
That's sad, unfortunately.
Buyer beware out there for folks that are buying some of these electronic kits for kids. It's, in fact, some of these parts might be floor scrapings. Giving back, I think, is a great piece of advice. Even if you're new, it seems to me that there's something that brought you there that you can share with somebody else. Maybe it's not all of the amateur radio that you accumulate over time, but it could be just the enthusiasm.
Right. And most clubs are always clamoring for new people to serve as club officers. And you don't necessarily have to, you know much about ham radio to be a secretary or a treasurer or whatever, you know, or even president or vice president.
What amateur radio club do you belong to?
Panama City Amateur Radio Club is our local club here. We've got around 120 members, but, you know, it's like any typical club. You've got, you know, roughly about 5 to 10% that are actively doing things. And I have to admit, I haven't been super active in the club until just recently. I've started going back to club meetings and stuff because I've had other things going on in my life and that kind of thing. So, you know, it's just like ham radio, you know, sometimes I'm more active than others, you know, but I keep my fingers in there.
Does the club have a like marketing plan? Does it know how many potential amateurs there are in Panama City? What the potential opportunity is to get people who are already licensed?
I don't know that they have necessarily a marketing plan like that per se, but they do several things. Of course, we have regular amateur radio testing with the volunteer exam program. That's available at least monthly. And they also, every week they do what's called Beginner's Academy. They do a Zoom meeting on various topics that teach different little snippets of something in a ham radio and that kind of thing. And of course we have our normal business meetings, which are, you know, the boring business meetings, you know, but the value I find in that is, you know, they do keep up with different contests going on and ham fests and things like that. Like there's a couple contests that they just had recently that I wasn't aware of till I went to the club meet, and I'm like, oh, that sounds like fun. So I'm going to go jump on 10 meters and do the 10 meter contest or whatever. So that's valuable. But then the other meetings, they meet every week, and then they have just rag chews and things like that. And sometimes they do projects and stuff. Yeah.
So there's a lot of activities.
Yes.
That are different. So it's not the weekly meeting or the monthly meeting.
Right. Right.
The business at the beginning until everybody fell asleep, and then the speaker afterwards.
Right. They're doing pretty good. It's one of the better clubs that I've been associated with. So,
Rick, I want to thank you so much for joining me on the QSO Today podcast. This was a lot of fun. I enjoyed the conversation. I hope you did too. With that, I want to wish you 73, and thank you so much for joining me.
It's been an honor, Eric, and I hope that somebody finds something interesting, and I do have more details on my QRZ page. I kind of did a little ditty based on your QSO podcast a while ago, outlining some of the interesting things I thought of my ham radio career, and we didn't even touch on even half of those. So, but I do appreciate it, and wish you a Shavua Tov.
That means good week, Shavua Tov, to you. That concludes this episode of QSO Today. I hope that you enjoyed this QSO with Rick. Please be sure to check out the show notes that include links and information about the topics that we discussed. Go to www.qsotoday.com and put an NZ2I in the search box at the top of the page. You may notice that some of the episodes are transcribed into written text. If you'd like to sponsor this or any of the episodes into written text, please contact me. Support the QSO Today podcast by first joining the QSO Today email list by pressing on the subscribe buttons on the show notes page. I will not spam you or share your email address with anyone. Become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor buttons on the show notes pages. Your value for value support is recognized on the QSO Today podcast and in the weekly show notes. Use our Amazon link when you shop on Amazon. Clicking on this link before you enter Amazon will allow Amazon to pay us a small commission on what you purchase. This is a very painless way to support the QSO Today podcast. QSO Today is syndicated on every podcast platform, including Spotify and the iTunes Store. Until next time, this is Eric 4Z1UG 73. The QSO Today podcast is a product of KEG Media, Inc., who is solely responsible for its content.